Thank you, Janice. During the course of embryonic development, cells in the embryo undergo remarkable changes in their shape and also in their internal structures. And I know I probably speak for many of the people in this room, and it was certainly true for me that one of the significant moments of my life and what drove me to become a developmental biologist was seeing these visible changes occurring in living embryos. And I think it's in part because the cells in an embryo are very large often, and because the events of embryonic development are very rapid, that these morphological changes in shape and structure and internal organization have such a great visual impact. Now, although these changes seem very special related to embryonic development, it's probably true that most of the motors and molecules involved in governing these changes are the same cytoskeletal elements, the same motors and molecules that continue to function throughout the life of the cell. And one of the expectations, though, from potentially one of the advantages of developmental biological systems like embryos is that because of the size and because of the rapidity and because these cell shape changes occur in very precise regions of the embryo at precise times, that if we want to understand how a cell controls its internal structure or controls its shape, then an embryo, then the events of embryonic development will not only tell us, if we understand how those events occur in an embryo, we may also be able to understand how these structures are generally controlled during the life of all cells. So the work that I'm going to talk to you about tonight is describes basically a project that began several years ago that's directed at the internal organization of cells and how cells move organelles and, as you'll see, lipid droplets and yolk vesicles from one region of the cell to the other. This process occurs also in many embryonic developments. I'm going to tell you about this process in Drosophila. Could we have the first slide? The Drosophila embryo starts its development, most of you know, as a fertilized egg and goes through a series of cleavage divisions. Initially, the cytoplasm of the egg is composed of, in addition to regular cytoplasmic components like mitochondria and cytoskeleton, it also has large yolk inclusions, lipid vesicles. If you shine a light through such an egg, the egg is opaque and basically uniformly opaque. After the embryo proceeds through these cleavage divisions, the nuclei migrate out to the surface of the egg, and there's a local clearing where the nuclei excludes yolk and lipid. But it's only after these cleavage divisions stop and the embryo enters into cycle 14 that there's a remarkable clearing of the cytoplasm, such that the surface cytoplasm becomes very clear and transparent, and the central cytoplasm remains dense and opaque. And this clearing is due to the removal of two storage organelles. They're large proteinaceous yolk vesicles that are about 5 microns in diameter, and also little small droplets of lipid that are about 0.5 micron in diameter and don't appear to be surrounded by any membranous structure. And during the process of clearing, these two organelles are specifically moved about 35-40 microns from the surface of the Drosophila embryo. So during the early cleavage stages, the final cleavage stages 12 and 13, these, in this color-coded slide, you can see the yolk vesicles and lipid droplets in blue and yellow, are basically homogeneously distributed throughout the cytoplasm and below the nuclei. But then as the embryo enters cycle 13, the yolk vesicles begin to move away from the surface, and in cycle 14, the lipid droplets follow. Now, in this embryo, running perpendicular to the surface, are microtubules. They're plus ends directed in, located basically at this position, the embryo about 35 microns from the surface, and they're minus ends up at the surface. If you inject or treat embryos with drugs that disrupt these microtubules, you disrupt this transport. Now, if you follow an follow the process in individual embryos, and it's easy to do with following the yolk vesicles because they're fairly large. What you see is that the clearing of yolk begins in cycle 13 and occurs with a fairly uniform and almost boring process. It occurs only during interphase when there are stable microtubules, and you can, in time-lapse video tapes of embryos, you can see individual yolk vesicles move through distances, perpendicular distances along the surface. The clearing of the lipid droplets is actually much more interesting, because during this whole period, from cycle 11 through cycle 14, the lipid droplets are attached to microtubules and are moving up and down along there with very rapid speed, saltating up and down the length of the microtubule. So during this whole period here as well, these lipid droplets are in rapid movement in both directions, in the plus and the minus end directed movement. But suddenly, in about 15 minutes into the cycle 14, these lipid vesicles move in a bulk movement from the surface down about 35 microns from the surface, and then they stay there. And so one of the questions that I'd like to address in this talk is, how is it, if vesicles are moving up and down along microtubules, how is it that you control the bulk redistribution of those vesicles? There's a second feature that makes the lipid vesicles more interesting than the yolk vesicle clearing. In this slide, we're using fluorescent markers to be able to follow the clearing. Yolk vesicles clear from the surface. This is, again, early cleavage during cycle 14. They clear, but when yolk clears, it remains in the interior of the embryo. And so these, and you can see in this early gastral embryo that the fluorescence is still in the central region of the embryo. One of the special features of the clearing of lipid droplets is, while it occurs rapidly in the middle of cycle 14 and completely, as the embryos enter the gastrulation phase, the cells are still connected to this underlying yolk sac, and all the lipid vesicles move back up into the cells. And we call this second phase clouding of the lipid vesicles. That means that, from the standpoint of transport, within a period of an hour, these lipid vesicles undergo two major changes in their distribution. So, to understand what controls these, how it is that cells position these lipid droplets, what are the forces that cause the bulk distribution of these lipids change, what you would like to know, and what we set out to ask, was, first of all, whether we can explain the bulk redistribution of lipid droplets in terms of properties and behaviors of individual lipid droplets. So can we take the whole population behavior and break it down to the behavior of individual lipid droplets? The second question you'd like to know is that, during these developmental phases, if it does depend on particular properties, what are the properties that change in development that cause or associated with this change in distribution? And the last thing we'd like to know is, what are the genes that are involved in controlling those properties, and how do those gene activities regulate the changes in distribution? To address these questions, what we my laboratory set up a collaboration with the laboratory of Stephen Block at Princeton to take advantage of the optical imaging and optical tweezer techniques that were developed in the Block lab. And this collaboration has been largely the work of two postdocs, Michael Welty in my lab and Steve Gross in the lab of Stephen Block. And most of the results I'm going to tell you about today were derived from work that those two postdocs have done together. First of all, I'd like to show you a videotape of fly embryos. The first sequence of this videotape should show you a living Drosophila embryo during the process of clearing. This is again this opaque Drosophila embryo during cleavage. If you look closely, you can see these mitotic divisions and this slight clearing on the surface of the embryo. You can see, possibly make out, individual nuclei here. And then as the embryo enters cycle 14, there's a clearing of the cytoplasm, first yolk, and then lipid, and then a process of cellularization and the onset of gastrulation. And during gastrulation, you can see the cells becoming visibly cloudy again as the embryo gastrulates. Now, what Michael Welty was able to do was to develop techniques for obtaining high resolution by taking single Drosophila embryos, suspending them in a halocarbon oil, and then gently flattening or squashing the embryo under a cover slip. So that you basically, and this allows you, what we're looking at here is the surface, this is the surface of a such a crushed embryo, and these are individual lipid droplets. These are the nuclei here, this is the apical surface, and if you can follow the individual lipid droplets, I think there's one right here that will make a particularly long run in the apical direction. You can see, in fact, most of the vesicles in this embryo, this is an embryo during the clouding phase, and most of the vesicles are actually in movement, and they're mostly moving along this apical basal direction along microtubule tracts. These lipid droplets are, because of their buoyant density, it's possible to easily fractionate Drosophila embryos and obtain a purified population of these lipid droplets. And you can reconstitute these droplets with vertebrate microtubules. And you can what's shown here is that the lipid droplet, we can reconstitute the association of these lipid droplets with microtubules. They bind tightly. What Steve Gross has done has put this preparation in an optical tweezer, and he's moving the lipid droplet around. You can see the microtubule get kind of dragged along. One of our goals is to establish in vitro motility, We haven't been able to do that. Now, this next sequence is what we're actually going to do is use optical tweezers, which are a way of generating force on individual lipid droplets. And what you're going to see, the tweezer, optical tweezers, is positioned here, and there's a little individual lipid droplet. It's moving into the field of the tweezer, and we just turned on the optical tweezer, and you probably saw the droplet being jumped back, and it's held in position. When the laser's turned off, the vesicle goes on in its movement. So we'll watch the sequence one more time. The goal of this is, because we can calibrate the forces that the laser generates, we can calibrate the forces that are required to stall lipid vesicles as they move along these microtubule tracts in vitro. This is actually one of the first cases where this optical tweezers have been used to measure forces in vitro. Here's again the vesicle. Watch, the trap comes on. There, do you see the vesicle? It jumped back into the position, jumped back into the optical trap, and now it's released and the vesicle moves along. By calibrating, you have the next slide? By experiments such as these, what Steve has been able to do is that by calibrating the forces generated by the optical tweezers, has been able to measure the forces required to stall vesicles moving along microtubules in either the apical or basal directions. One interesting feature is that those forces are balanced. It takes about the same force to stall 70% of the vessels, whether they're moving in the apical or inward or outward direction. The forces that are required here are in the range of 4 to 5 piconewtons. This is close to the forces that are measured, that are generated by individual kinesin motors in vitro, and suggests that these lipid vesicles are being driven by a relatively small number of motors. Now, even though these forces are balanced, we believe that the motors that are driving the outward movement of vesicles are different motors than are driving the inward, and that comes from other optical measurements that we've made, including the measurements that are based on velocity, but also measurements that are based on the wobble of the vesicles as they move along microtubules, since kinesin motors generally move along single protofilaments and have very directed pathways, whereas dynein motors have a much greater wobble, and our outward directed, that is minus end directed movement, shows all the characteristics of dynein motors, whereas the inward directed movement shows the characteristics of the kinesin motors. Now, it's also possible so the question what one would like to know, say, during cycle 14, during clearing and clouding, is how are these properties governed? And if you, what we can, by making analyzing movies and time-lapse videos of individual vesicles. One of the interesting features is that it's possible to measure the velocity of individual vesicles. The velocities are in the range of about 400 or 500 nanometers. One of the striking features is that during these stages, and in fact during almost all of the conditions that we've used this system in, the apically or minus end-directed motilities are about 20 to 30% greater than the basally or inwardly directed motilities. And what this would mean is that if vesicles were moving about the same amount of time in the outward and in the inward direction, overall with these velocities during a given process, what would happen is there would be a net change or a net redistribution of the vesicles in the outward direction, because they're moving the same amount of time, but they're moving faster, then they'll go farther, and you'll have a net redistribution in the apical direction. If you look, though, during cycle 12, 13, or 11, and then 12, or during early cycle 14, when the embryo is undergoing clearing and undergoing cut, and ask about travel times inward and outward, what you see is a remarkable feature, and what we believe is the major clue to how this process is regulated, in that, in general, in most stages, during both clearing and during clouding, the time in and time out, the time the vesicles spend moving in and out, are pretty much the same. And what this results in, given the differences in velocity, is a net outward or apical movement. That's characteristic of clouding. During the early interphase, we suspect there's probably also a net outward movement, but it's difficult to follow because the cell cycles are so short, there's probably no stable microtubules. The striking feature for us is that, and what we believe governs clearing, which is the reversal of the direction and now transport in the basally or plus end direction, is a remarkable elongation of the run time from about an average of 2 seconds to about four seconds. And this is enough then to account during early cleavage for basically, and during clouding for basically apical or outward directed motility. But that change in the duration of the run is what accounts then for this net inward or plus end directed motility during the process of clearing. So now, if we know that what's being governed here, what's being controlled is the length of runs, the next question is, how is this controlled? What are the processes that come, what turns on in the beginning of cycle 14, what accounts for this change in the length of run? The first clue for us in our lab came from observations where alpha amanitin was injected into Drosophila embryos, and alpha amanitin, these were experiments designed to identify the Drosophila analog of a mid-blastula transition. That is, that time in Drosophila development when the fly embryo required its first, when processes in the fly embryo visibly required their first zygotic transcription. If you inject Drosophila embryos with alpha amanitin, the embryos go through normal go through the cleavage divisions normally, but when they enter cycle 14, one of the first and obvious features is that they don't undergo cytoplasmic clearing, suggesting that there was a single gene, there was at least one gene in the genome that was required for this transition. And then, so Pauline Merrill and I, many years ago now, designed a screen involving using translocations, which allowed us to generate deficiency embryos, embryos that were now homozygously deleted for different regions of the genome. Basically, in a relatively small number of crosses, we were able to span through the entire Drosophila genome, and what we identified was a single region of the embryo which, when deleted, mimicked the effects of alpha amanitin on cytoplasmic clearing. And this, the embryos that are deficient for this region are shown here, and what you can see in the striking phenotype is that the embryo has cleared the nuclei, you can see at the surface, and the striking feature of these embryos is that yolk has cleared normally, but the lipid inclusions have not undergone their normal clearing process, and in fact, if you look, you can see there's, a clear area more basally and a more dense area apically, as though rather than clearing, the lipid vesicles have undergone a premature clouding or an apical direction during early cycle 14. And if you look, if you do squashes and do detailed analysis in terms of behavior of individual lipid droplets. In wild-type embryos, again, during the clearing phase, you have this saltatory movement, but with a net displacement basally. So over 20 seconds, you'd have a displacement of 1 to 2microns. And in halo embryos during the same period, you see a net displacement apically. So then, what is it that halo is a gene product that's required then, zygotically, must be transcribed, and it's required for this effect? What can we find out anything more about what it is that halo is doing? To investigate this, we use the optical tweezers to measure the forces. And I should have indicated that the forces that are required to stall vesicles are thought to be related to the number of motors that are operating on that vesicle. And in wild type, if you remember, the forces that drive vesicle movement apical are always balanced with those basally. But in mutant embryos, so in wild type, they're balanced basically. In embryos from halo, if you look at the outward directed movement, there's more force, and therefore we believe more motors operating in the apical direction than in the basal direction. And this somehow, in ways that we don't fully understand, this difference in the number of operative motors accounts for or influences some role in determining the length of the runs in the outward versus inward direction. Now, we actually don't believe that halo encodes specifically the motors involved. We believe that these dynein and kinesin-like motors are supplied maternally, but that somehow what halo does acts as a regulatory function which controls the displacement or utilization of motors on these vesicles. Now, one of the halo is the only zygotically active gene that's involved in controlling this clearing process. Most of the and therefore all of the other processes, the motors, the microtubule components, all these other products are supplied by as maternal gene products as RNAs already in the egg. Now, then the question becomes, how is it that activity of this zygotic activity of this halo gene, transcription of this halo gene, presumably at the mid-blast of the transition, how does it interact with this? What is it actually interacting with? What does it control? And can we identify genetically some of these maternally supplied genetic components? And our first clue, and our only at the moment handle in a real genetic sense on what those other maternally supplied components are, came actually from experiments that were done in Christian and Hussein Fulhard's lab for different purposes. I believe they were doing screens for maternal effect mutants that altered pattern, and Yanni with her eagle eyes, I think, recognized that there was, in one of the stocks, embryos were being produced, when these maternal stocks were being produced, that were particularly clear and photogenic. And this stock was called Klarsicht, and her lab have used this stock frequently whenever we cross it as a background when we wanted to have particularly photogenic pictures of fly embryos. It's one of our trade secrets. Next slide. This shows you some pictures of Klarsicht embryos, and basically what happens again in wild-type embryos is they clear their lipid, and then they cloud. And what happens in a Klarsicht embryo, what struck us after we had begun more detailed analysis, was that while Klarsicht embryos appear at a gross morphological level to be normal during clearing, when the embryo should undergo this clouding process, the lipid vesicles remain basally. They never move back into the cells. And that's one of the reasons why the Klarsicht embryos were so much more photogenic and clearer than gave clearer morphology than this wild-type embryo. Although the embryos appear normal during these early phases, if we do detailed analysis of vesicle movement, it's fairly clear that already during clearing, these embryos derived from Klarsicht mothers are already abnormal. If you look at individual lipid vesicles, they're very sluggish in their movement. A much smaller fraction of the vesicles at any individual time are moving. Their lengths of their run, their runs are shorter. And what's very curious is also there's a net bias in that they don't show the norm, the same net bias that wild-type embryos do, in that they show a more shorter runs, but with a basal, generally basally directed movement. And this, these motility features are established during early cleavage and appear, remain visible during during stages when the embryo should be undergoing clearing as well as clouding. And so essentially, there's none of the developmental changes that would normally occur in wild-type embryos occur in CLAR-cyst embryos. Another clue as to the nature of the defect in CLAR comes when you try to measure the motors, find that they require much smaller laser forces to stall the motors and to stall the lipid droplets. And you can actually plot these out, and it's, the plots like this have led us to hypothesize that there's a unit motor force, a unit motor of about 1.8 piconewtons force, and that in normal development there are multiple motors associated with each vesicle, and that CLAR-cyst in some way defines a ground state where there are a minimal number of motors. So in a simple kind of cartoon model, we believe that there's a transport system which is possible in the embryos, which you define as a ground state where you have both minus and plus end directed motors. And when the motors are aligned in, arranged in this way, there's a net bias of the kinesin motor, perhaps because it's more precessive, and it leads to a net longer runs in the plus direction. Wild-type embryos, however, during this process, don't utilize this simple transport system. They use a transport system that involves CLAR and defines a more CLAR-cyst and defines a more active and powerful and developmentally regulatable system. One of the major differences between CLAR wild-type embryos and embryos that have CLAR and embryos that don't is that individual lipid vesicles appear to be able to bind more motors, to have 2, 3, 4 motors operating simultaneously on individual lipid droplets. These are usually appear to be added always in tandem, so you always add one plus and one minus n directed motor. The other feature of CLAR embryos is that you don't see that wild-type embryos, CLAR wild-type embryos versus CLAR minus embryos, is that the motilities of this complex are developmentally regulatable. So we imagine that there are little green factors that can bind to CLAR and regulate the displacement of these motors or the utilization of these motors such that the net movement of the vesicle will be in one direction or the other. So to developmentally regulate your transport, we believe that CLAR plays an essential role. Now, if this is one possible candidate for these regulatory factors, is obviously HALO, the halozygotically supplied gene product. If that were true, what you would predict is that if HALO is producing its effects by regulating CLAR, that if you made the double mutant, HALO activity would be irrelevant and the embryo would show the CLAR phenotype, and that's shown in the next slide. So this is a HALO embryo again, this is a CLAR embryo, and the HALO-CLAR embryo is in all respects indistinguishable from CLAR itself, suggesting that the HALO only has a function in regulating CLAR. Now, throughout this talk, these two transport systems differ in our cartoon by the number of motors, and we imagine that we've cartooned this as number of motors largely because what we do in our optical tweezer measurements, we measure different forces associated with apical or basal movements, and we interpret those as forces. What's still unclear to us, and what is one of the major areas of our research at the moment, is how is it that numbers of motors and numbers of operative motors affect any one of these processes? How is it that adding more motors doesn't appear in wild-type embryos to affect velocities, average velocities, because they remain pretty much the same, but it does affect durations of runs. And how is it in vivo, in a real organism, are motors used and utilized and controlled in ways added and subtracted to give you controlled motility? Another feature of this model that I'm presenting you is that the animal actually has two transport systems available to it. It has this regular run-of-the-mill transport system that's slow and gets the job, gets many jobs done, and then it has this wonderful, complicated, developmentally even in the absence of the CLAR system. And one fact that I haven't told you is that although CLAR was identified in screens for maternal effect mutants, and it is a maternal effect mutant in the sense that the CLAR gene product is applied to the embryo, embryos from CLAR homozygous mothers develop perfectly normally, grow up to adults, and in fact, you can maintain homozygous viable stocks that have only this minimal transport system. The HALO gene was initially identified by the alpha manitin experiments and by making large deficiencies, and initially those deficiencies died as embryos, but probably, we know now, because they were large and deleted other genes. Michael's been recently able to generate single band deficiencies for HALO. The HALO gene has shown that they too survive to adult stages. So this is a purely facultative transport system that's available to the embryo for moving its lipid droplets around. What we then ask is this system really specific for this lipid droplet transport only in the embryo? And for a while we thought that was the case, but then as Michael obtained more alleles of CLAR, what he realized is that they showed a subtle phenotype, at least one additional subtle phenotype, and what I'm going to have to show you very quickly is just sections of developing Drosophila eye disc, and these are stained with a nuclear antigen that recognizes the nuclei of the photoreceptor cells. And you can see in a wild-type embryo that during these late differentiative stages, the nuclei are all arranged apically in the cells in a very regular pattern. And if you section eyes from CLAR-sished embryos, what you see is that very few of the nuclei have remained in this apical position. And like the lipid droplets in wild-type embryos, have moved into the basal regions of the cell, some of them even moving so far basally that the nuclei are beginning to aggregate through the axons at the base of these photoreceptor cells. So what this tells us is this facultative transport system isn't only used for moving lipid droplets around in the embryo, but is used at a variety of stages during development when you must move organelles or position organelles in defined positions in the embryo or in the adult. Now, there's only one other gene in the Drosophila genome that's known to produce this phenotype. It's a gene called MARBLES. It's been worked on extensively by Janet Fisher-Wiese. And what I can, after we had this eye phenotype and looked at the map positions, I can tell you that the idea occurred to us that CLAR CLAR mapped close to a region where MARBLES had also, Janet Fisher-Wiese had also, localized MARBLES too, and the complementation result tests indicate that CLAR and MARBLES are in fact a single complementation group that is they encode the same gene. It was a wonderful thing for us because Fisher-Wiese had been spending a substantial amount of her time cloning and characterizing the Drosophila MARBLES gene, and she has this gene cloned. What I can tell you now is that it is large. It is over more than, not you, as I give my little statement here, you'll realize why I was so glad that Janet was doing this rather than me. That it's large, it extends over more than 100 kb of the genomic sequences. The predicted protein is about 200 kilodaltons in size. It is novel in all respects, and we've been unable to find any structural motifs or any clues as to what its function would be. And one of the things we're doing right now, obviously, is in collaboration with Genesis Lab, trying to develop antibodies to look at the localization of these products. But CLAR clearly defines then a novel protein, which we believe associates with cargo, associates with transport vessels, and allows their transport to be developmentally, and the directionality of that transport to be developmentally regulated. Okay, could we have the lights? Oh, last slide. Just indicate the people who've done the work. largely in my lab, Michael Welty, Mariah Postner did the original characterization of Halo, and Steve Block's lab, Steve Gross, and recently established a collaboration with the Fisher Beast lab based on the realization that Kalar and Marvel are allelic. Now, in the last minute, what I'd like to do is just speculate a little bit about these genes, Kalar, Fisher, and Halo, and contrast them with the genes that that Yanni and I had worked on in our earlier mutagenesis screens in Heidelberg, and also the genes that Ed Lewis has worked on in the bithorax complex. One of the features of the mutagenesis screens that Yanni and I did in Heidelberg and that Ed did were, in fact, and looking back on them, they seem very endpoint determined. We basically scored embryonic development at the end. We scored embryos at the end of embryonic development, and we looked for dramatic changes in the final morphology of the embryo. And many of Ed's mutants were originally derived because he was looking at final alterations in adult morphologies. In the screens that we identified in Heidelberg, there's actually a fascinating number of mutants, and all of them, though, the substantial number of them, seem to produce these long-acting final effects on morphology because they control the programming of cells, they control the patterning of the embryo, the direction of cells into specific fates. What's remarkable to me in going through the collection of all of the mutants that were identified in the Heidelberg screens is the very small number of genes that are actually involved in controlling cellular processes and producing the actual morphological changes that occur in embryos. And for some reason, when you do screens which are endpoint related and rely on changes in final morphology, you miss and fail to detect those genes that are actually involved in the process of morphology itself. Clearly, the Klarsicht and Halo genes were not identified in Heidelberg, in the Heidelberg screens. They wouldn't even have been lethal. So I think that one of the lessons from this observation is that as we as developmental biologists come to focus more and more on the actual cellular processes of development, we will have to look more and more at cells and at those processes themselves and not make assumptions about the final endpoints. And when, and I believe that the results from the Halo and Kalar screens and other screens that we and other people have done in the lab suggest that when you do look at the actual process, you will be able to identify. And you look at the process with a subtle and careful enough eye, you will be able to identify the relevant genes that are involved. So I think I'd like to stop there. Thank you for your attention.